nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Okay, so I think we're ready to go. I'd like to welcome everybody to the NCLT seminars for this fall. We're excited to start up again after a summer break, and we're excited to have Professor Dave Gustin from the Arizona State University, and he's the director of the Center for Nanotechnology and Society, and he's coming from a political science perspective there, and we're excited to have this view for our NCLT seminars, and I'm going to turn it over to him today.
Thank you very much. I really want to thank the National Center for this opportunity to talk about the work that we're doing here at the Center for Nanotechnology and Society at Arizona State University. I'm sitting in the Biodesign Institute, which is our technical partner here for the kind of social science and humanistic study that we do with nanotechnology. I'd like to thank the Biodesign Institute for hosting me as well. I'm sure that many of you are familiar with the legislation that the U.S. Congress passed in 2003, the 21st Century Nanotechnology R&D Act, which authorized a great portion of the National Nanotechnology Initiative, as well as created an expectation of doing societal implications work about nanotechnology. And you'll see a little photo of Ray Kurzweil there, who testified about the importance of studying the societal aspects of nanotechnology along with the performance of the nanoscale science and engineering research itself. The legislation also provided for an expectation that this societal work would happen alongside of the nanoscale science and engineering work and would provide for public input into the priorities of that research as well. And the Center for Nanotechnology and Society at ASU builds on these expectations that were embedded in this legislation. In fulfillment of that legislation, the United States National Science Foundation had a competition for what was originally to be one Center for Nanotechnology and Society, and they ended up creating two centers and two additional projects. We're one node of this new network for nanotechnology and society here at ASU, funded to about $6.2 million over 5 years. Santa Barbara is another node at a slightly less funding, and additional money to projects at a collaboration of Harvard, UCLA, and the University of South Carolina. And together, these four entities constitute a network for nanotechnology and society. The center at ASU is itself a network. CNSASU involves the activities of more than 80 individuals at the seven institutions that you see there, Madison, Georgia Tech, North Carolina State, Rutgers, UC Boulder, and University of Georgia, in addition to ASU. And then we're actually accumulating additional universities as we move along. So we're a sort of broad and embracing kind of operation as well. The mission of CNSASU is a traditional kind of academic mission in the sense that we do research, we train new scholars, but we also hope to engage the public, policymakers, business leaders, and nanoscale science engineering researchers themselves in the kind of work that we're doing. And we partner with NSE laboratories like this Biodesign Institute here to introduce what we call a greater reflexiveness into the R&D process. And I'll be explaining a little bit about what that term reflexiveness means, if you'll bear with me for just a moment. The major research programs that we have here are divided into two areas. One, a program that my colleague Dan Sarowitz and I developed that we call real-time technology assessment, which is in essence an effort to try to understand emerging technologies, emerging knowledge-based technologies, before they become so reified that you can't do anything about it. And then a set of thematic research clusters that are a little bit more traditional social science and humanistic research. And you can see the titles of those programs within those larger groupings on your screen, and I'll talk about them in some detail. the overall goal of this cluster of activities, like I suggested, is encouraging reflexivity among nanoscale science and engineering performers, and to build a capacity for what we call anticipatory governance. And here's hopefully fulfilling on the promise to clear up some of that jargon. What we mean by reflexivity is a capacity for social learning among all scales of entities, individuals, groups, institutions, broader publics, in the nanoscale science and engineering enterprise narrowly, in society more broadly, that expands the domain of and informs the available choices in decision-making about nano. And these are choices that go on all the time in public settings where R&D priorities are set, in laboratories where scientists are making decisions about priorities to pursue in the laboratory or materials to use in the laboratory. Those choices are getting made all the time, and what we hope to do is get people to be a little bit more reflexive, that is to learn about the choices that they're making, how they influence potential outcomes, and perhaps how to make those choices a little better. Anticipatory governance is, again, a capacity extended throughout society that can act on a variety of inputs to manage emerging knowledge-based technologies while such management is still possible. And so there's a something of a dilemma here that we talk about in our jargon upstream, which is the activity that happens still in the research laboratory, as opposed to downstream activities that happen, say, in marketing a product. And when you're working upstream, you have a better chance, if you will, at diverting or deflecting or steering, if you sort of think about the problem of deflecting a meteor that might be headed to Earth. If you start early enough, a very small shove will move it away from a target. But it's hard to figure out what you need to do and what the possibilities are when something is so far away, when something is upstream. So that's the dilemma that we try to confront in the work that we're doing in anticipating things that might happen. A little bit more on the governance side of anticipatory governance. What we're after is not government. That is, it's not exclusively a public sector activity, but governance, something that is broadly distributed through society that includes a variety of social participants, not just the public sector. Second, that there's a wide opportunity between the sort of binary choice that people are often confronted with in respect to new emerging knowledge-based technologies. So science finds, genius invents, industry applies, man adapts was the slogan of a World's Fair many decades ago, and that suggests that the activities of science and individual genius and industry are relatively automatic, and the only role that human beings have in the rest of the process is to simply sit back and let the innovation roll over them. That's one extreme. Another extreme are the kinds of moratoriums for nanotechnology, for example, that have been proposed by the Canada-based ETC group, by Friends of the Earth, and so forth. So the point is to look between these endpoints of simply do and get out of the way, or don't do and forego any possible benefits. And there are a wide array of mechanisms that exist between these two extremes that we're used to dealing with other technologies that we have in our society. So we have licensing restrictions based on age or other kinds of testing capacity. There's liability and indemnification of the suppliers of new technologies. There's intellectual property, which is used both for protective purposes, for publicity purposes, and for public policy purposes. There's testing regimes, there are treaties, there are a variety of public understanding of science, both formal and informal, and then there are a variety of activities that the public can engage in, from sitting back and listening to discussing to taking their support or their opposition out into the streets. So these are the kinds of mechanisms that we're thinking about that exist between simply saying, go ahead, do the technology, and let's figure out later on how we react to it, or let's forego any possible advances as well. On the anticipatory side, this idea that social scientists should be working hand-in-hand with natural scientists is not something that started with our work with the 2003 congressional legislation. The quote that you see in the overhead, competent social scientists should work hand-in-hand with natural scientists, so that problems may be solved as they arise, and so that many of them may not arise in the first instance. This is a sentiment that reaches back to a report of the National Research Council in the 1930s. Okay, so the idea has been around for a very long time, and it's only more recently that we've had the capacity, the tools in the social sciences, as well as the will politically and the funding through funding agencies to begin to implement this sentiment. This concept of anticipatory governance is beginning to take hold, and I'm pleased to report that even as early as almost 2 years ago, Mike Rocco has begun to use the term as well. So now I'd like to go through our research programs in a little bit more detail. The first of these real-time technology assessment programs we call Research and Innovation Systems Analysis, and it asks questions like, what kind of NSE research is going on, who's doing it, how can we measure NSE's contribution to broad social goals, and what kind of training in NSE do we need in regional labor markets. I'm going to talk in most detail about the research program assessment aspect, that is, who's doing what kind of NSE research, but please feel free to ask me questions later about the public value mapping and the workforce assessment activities as well. I know you're not going to be able to read this overhead, but one of the major hurdles that we faced in doing social science of nanoscience was trying to figure out what nanotechnology is from a social science perspective. There are, of course, debates in science and engineering about what makes nanotechnology, whether it's unique, whether it's novel, how much is it chemistry, how much is it materials, how much is it biology, and so forth. But our group who was working on bibliometrics and patent analysis went through an incredibly extensive activity to attempt to create an operational definition of nanotechnology in order to query these databases. And you can't just type in nano asterisk, a nanostar, and have it get something that's sensible. And what you barely see here is what their search protocol actually looks like and the kinds of results it gets from searching a particular database. That took nearly a year of development that included work that they did, as well as polling scientists and engineers about whether they thought their work was reflected in the outcomes of these search protocols. The results of these searches through their global search from 1990 to 2006, you can see here from the Web of Science, over 400,000 articles, representing nearly 3% of the Science Citation Index over the period, and for a most recent period of 2005-2006, over 4% of the SCI. Large numbers of articles fit under this definition, larger than some of the other bibliometric databases that are being compiled. Large number of patents that you can see there, over 61,000 patent families from the 70 patent authorities across the globe. What you can do then with that data is begin to look at where nanotechnology activity is happening. And what you see on this global map are red dots where there are cities with nanotechnology publication records of 1,000 or more. And you can see what looks like a fairly obvious sort of geographic pattern here, centered in the eastern United States, centered in Western Europe, but also a great deal of nano publication, as we know, as we're familiar with now, in China and the Pacific Rim. And I won't show you additional slides on this, but what you can do from each of these points is then drill down into any of these dots on the map and look at them by institution, look at them by investigator, look at their development over time, look at publication and patenting intensity in each of these nano districts, look at regional concentrations and subject drivers. So, for example, there are sort of four different kinds of nanotechnologies that might be identified through the bibliometric mapping: nanobio, nanochemistry, materials, and so forth. And you can sort of see which clusters have greatest strength in each of these nano districts. And so there's a whole lot of fine data analysis that can occur in each of these geographic areas. Another piece of work that's coming out of this project area is a question about the platform or generality nature, the platform technology or generality of nanotechnology. And there are large-scale claims based on very little empirical evidence, a whole lot of intuition perhaps, that nanotechnology is going to be a platform technology. The phrase that we've heard used in public policy circles is the next industrial revolution. Well, here we can provide some empirical data to suggest that the generality of nanotechnology is, in fact, very significant. And I won't go into the great technical details because I'm not sure I understand them fully as well, but what we're doing here is comparing nanotechnology in the left-hand columns with pharmaceuticals in the center columns and with information computing technology in the right-hand columns, looking at the relationship between patent citations for each of these areas. And the higher the scores on this generality index, the more general, the greater sort of platform capacity the technology has. And in looking back over these several years, because you have to lag the citations for patents, looking back in through the early 90s, we see that the generality index scores for nanotechnology are much more similar to the generality scores for computers information technology than they are for pharmaceuticals, suggesting that nanotechnology is in fact developing in this general platform fashion, and that we might then in fact expect the same qualitative kinds of change that we got from information computer technology rather than the change that we got from pharmaceuticals. A second area of research that I'd like to talk about is this real-time technology assessment program 2, public opinion and values. And what we're after here is, what does the public know and feel about nanotechnology? How does the media influence that public perspective? And also, what do scientists know and feel about nanotechnology? And in fact, in the data that I'll show you, comparing some of our public opinion polling with scientists' opinion, this is where some really interesting stuff occurs. And I'll leave the media influence discussion to question period, if you like. This is something that may be particularly interesting to the National Center. This is a comparison of 2004 and 2007 polling. The 2004 is in the darker bar. Has outreach made a difference? Nano knowledge among the public 2004 versus 2007. And you can see there are only marginal changes from the polling that was done in 2004, most of them upward. The question about the scale of nanotechnology versus the scale of an atom being slightly downward, but nothing really out of the range of statistical significance. We have a lot of work to do in getting to the public and increasing their basic knowledge about nanotechnology, if in fact that is one of our goals. And now I'm going to talk a little bit about the perceived risks and benefits of nanotechnology. And what you see here is a comparison of the perceived risks between aware and unaware respondents. So these are folks in the darker bars who report and then have some knowledge about being aware of nanotechnology. The light blue bars are folks who are largely unaware of nanotechnology and what their expectation of perceived risks are. I'm sorry, the colors are reversed. The unaware is the darker bar. And you'll see that the more aware people are, by and large, the lower risks that they'll perceive. One thing to point out in this graph additionally is that the least worrisome risk for both the aware and the unaware public is the self-replicating nanobot scenario. People are vastly more concerned with loss of privacy, with nano arms, with loss of jobs, pollution, terrorism, than they are about self-replicating nanobots. And so I want to be, you know, sort of very strong about this, that if you hear people talking about the public fear of nanobots coming from ill-informed media or science fiction, there is no data that we know of to suggest that that's what the public is afraid of, and there are the bar graphs. Perceived benefits, again, you'll see that the aware public sees more and better things in nanotechnology than the unaware public. We think that this is very strongly a media effect, and you can ask me about that a little bit later. But basically, across the board, people see a whole variety of interesting benefits for nanotechnology. Now I'm going to compare the scientists and public opinion, and there are a couple of interesting things to note here. By and large, it's been the case in the history of emerging technologies that the scientists and technologists involved have underplayed risk compared to the way the public has perceived risk, and there's a great deal of research and data behind this. What you'll see on the far right, however, of this chart is that the scientists in light blue see more risk for nanotechnology in pollution and new human health concerns than does the public. This is perhaps a novel situation for emerging technologies and something that we want to pay more attention to. In the other risks, privacy, terrorism, arms race, and so forth, the public sees vastly greater risks than scientists and engineers do. Let me also go back down to that self-replicating nanobot bar again. It's not the case that no scientists believe that self-replicating nanobots pose risk. One in 20 there suggests that that there is a perceived risk. And these scientists in our sample are not just a wholesale cross-section of scientists. These scientists are actually derived from the citation analysis that we did in the earlier research project that I spoke of. This is a sample of the 300-odd respondents from the 1,000 or so most cited nanoscientists publishing in the United States. So there are still a few of those who think that self-replicating nanobots might be an issue as well. Here in benefits, the scientists show a perception of greater benefits than the public, by and large. I think that's where this information finishes, but please ask me more details of the public opinion work. A third area that we're doing research in is what we call deliberation and participation. And what we're after here is some of the stuff that gets at more of the anticipatory aspect. What plausible nano-enabled futures might occur through scenario development that I'll tell you about? How can we envision what responsible nanoscale science and engineering products look like? What are the cultural resonances of nanoscience and engineering futures, and how can the public be more engaged in nanoscale decision making? I'll talk mostly about the scenario development activities and this innovation space activity. We'll leave off critical core for the moment. You can ask me about that. And please, please, please ask me more about the National Citizens Technology Forum. We don't have any data from that. That's going to be happening this spring, and I can give you some of the details about what we'll be doing. So this is a draft cartoon or sketch of one of the nano scenarios that we're developing, and we've dubbed this SLEEP. And basically it involves a nano-enabled brain implant that can be directly manipulated. So you can learn through getting information beamed into the chip into your head while you are asleep. And what we've been doing, sorry about that, what we've been doing with these scenarios is that we generate them from a variety of places, from the technical literature, from the public science literature, from claims that scientists make in public forums like, say, appropriations committee meetings about what their intentions are, and the science fiction literature as well. And then we draft them out into what we call scenes, sort of one-page descriptions of what a future technology based on nano might look like. And then we vet these scenes with focus groups of scientists and engineers here at ASU, most in the Biodesign Institute here. And we get feedback from the scientists about whether this is something that is plausible, about what the technical hurdles or milestones might be. And so we actually, alongside the scenario, create a little mini roadmap for the technology as well. And right now we're in the stage of sort of vetting the scenarios that we've developed and creating those mini roadmaps. And so the idea is not to predict a future for nanotechnology as such, but it's to develop a scenario that will then that we will then expose to various other kinds of groups in society, to scientists, to science policy people, to the lay public, for their reflections, for their assessment, for their analysis, to develop more robust, broadly contextualized scenarios to get people thinking about what might happen in the future. Again, not prediction, but anticipation of the kinds of things that might happen. Another aspect of this forward-looking deliberation is a combination education research project that we have here on ASU campus called Innovation Space. And this is an activity of undergraduate students from the schools of design, engineering, and business here on campus. And they take a, I believe it's a 10-credit senior design seminar that fulfills the project requirements in the School of Design, in the School of Engineering, and the School of Business. And they collaborate in cross-functional teams to develop new products. And they usually have industrial sponsors from Intel and design firms and so forth. And so the Center for Nanotechnology and Society sponsored a set of these teams this past year. And what you're seeing is one of their models of a technology that they called Current, which, and this is a public kiosk that is coupled with nano-enabled piezoelectric floor tiles that would be placed in high-traffic public areas to absorb the pressure energy that foot traffic created, translated into electrical energy. And what these kiosks do is they follow in both an artistic and a sort of more accounting way the electricity that's generated. People can walk up to these kiosks, plug in their personal electrical items like their cell phones, draw energy from the energy that's being created in the room. They can watch the foot traffic in a sort of stylized visual fashion, and they can see exactly what contribution the foot traffic is putting in terms of the amount of electricity. So that's one of the products that one of the future products that they designed. Then in the fourth area of real-time technology assessment, we're basically trying to ask ourselves how it is that we're doing. What are we up to? How is the work that we're doing influencing the way the scientists and engineers that we're interacting with are doing their work, are organizing, and so forth? Basically, what we've discovered so far, and we're just barely 2 years into our work, is that we are beginning to see the basics of a change in knowledge and, in some sense, practice of the scientists and engineers that we're collaborating with. I can give you some specific details if you ask me about that in the question period. Moving along to those two thematic research cluster activities that sort of cross-cut our real-time technology assessment activities, these are more traditional, more curiosity-based research activities. One involves the nature of nanotechnology and equity and responsibility. So we want to explore the ways in which nanoscale science and engineering research interacts with ideas of social and economic equity and responsible innovation. And the kinds of techniques we use here include laboratory interactions, where social scientists and natural scientists are working close together in the natural science laboratories, workshops that bring scientists and engineers together with various interested communities, something that's called public value mapping that you saw back in that real-time technology assessment program one, that involves trying to understand what the gap is and how to fill that gap between the promises that get made about an emerging science and the fulfillment of societal outcomes. And then generally the broader impacts of nanoscale science and engineering. The image that you see there is an artist's representation of the biblical Tower of Babel. And one of the projects in the equity and responsibility is looking at religion as a source of additional kinds of values for thinking about nanotechnology. And one of the interesting findings of this work so far is that in the formal statements that religious organizations have produced about nanotechnology, there's vastly more interest on the part of those organizations in the equitable distribution of benefits that will arise from nanotechnology rather than the kinds of playing God issues that are stereotypical to the dialogue between science and religion. Other areas that we're working on include nanotechnology and ableism, with a colleague in Canada, Gregor Wolbring, thinking about how nanotechnologies for example, their diagnostic capacities will end up making us all seem disabled, and then working in some real detail with the laboratories here at the Biodesign Institute. the second thematic research cluster we call Human Identity, Enhancement, and Biology. And this is to investigate the historical, philosophical, cultural, and political dimensions to the interactions between human biology and human values in the context of nano. And so, although it may be the case that nanotechnology raises some novel issues or a novel configuration of issues, a lot of these issues have philosophical, cultural, and historical precedent. And so, particularly when talking about the interaction between technologies and the human body, whether external or internal to the body, talking about things that look like, that technologies that look like the replication of life, so in nanotechnology, making self-assembling materials, even if you're not talking about nanobots, making self-assembling materials out of biological material like DNA, these are all very philosophically and historically evocative concepts. One of the focal areas of this work is related to the scenario that I described to you earlier in nano-enabled neural interface systems. And you see some images there. And most people are by now familiar with this experiment on this gentleman, Matt Nagle, whose neuroprosthetic allows him to move a cursor on a computer screen through thought alone. And there are a number of technical hurdles in getting this to work and reducing it to practice and reducing practice to something that might in fact be consumable. And a number of the researchers involved in this kind of work think that, and here's the role of nanotechnology here, think that nanotechnology will allow you to get around some issues of, some vexing issues of infection, of direct connections rather than infrared or other kinds of hookups to the implanted chips. So some of the exemplary research questions here involve the nature of the priorities for doing this kind of research, what kinds of values are embedded in the research that's being done, the kinds of specific identity and enhancement concerns that follow on to the plausible ability to put a chip in someone's head and influence it remotely from the outside. And there are more focused ethical, social, legal policy questions as well, often involving things that happen in the laboratory, like doing research of this kind on non-human primates, as well as human primates, clinical decisions about undergoing potentially personality-changing procedures, and so forth. So those are the set of research projects that that we have, the real-time technology assessment projects, the thematic research clusters, those cross-cut. And what I just want to go back to, I don't have a slide for this, but I mentioned the National Citizens Technology Forum that we'll be doing in the spring, in March, in six sites across the country. And that will be one of the major integrating forces for this array of work. We'll be drawing data from basically every research stream that we have to produce information for a set of six groups of lay citizens across the country to deliberate on a topic in nanotechnology and policy. And the general topic that we've chosen for them are these issues of human identity enhancement and biology. And come March, when they sit down to deliberate, they'll have a slightly more refined sense of what will be going on. They'll refine the questions that they themselves will answer. They'll interact with experts about answering those questions and interact with each other. And hopefully they will come up with some interesting and provocative perspectives for both scientists and policymakers to consume. So I think I'll bring my presentation to a close. Again, there's our website for the Center for Nanotechnology and Society at ASU. And again, we operate under National Science Foundation sponsorship, and there's the cooperative agreement number, and thank you, NSF, and thank you, National Center for Learning and Teaching.
I think we can open to some Q&A. Any questions?
Yeah, I have a question. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you ever ask respondents in the perceived benefits and risks to elaborate on their answer? And if so, what do they say when they say something will give better national security and defense? How do they go about that?
Yeah, those questions are fairly close-ended. This is a telephone survey that's done under very tight time constraints, so we're not asking respondents in those particular surveys to elaborate. But we are going to be doing additional surveys in the future, and part of what we'll be doing there is sort of following up and expanding on things that we do find of interest. I'm not sure that the example of national security, for example, will be one of the things that we'll go into depth in, but we'll be going into depth on the human enhancement activities, because that's a core issue for us, as well as trying to go into depth on those areas where the scientists and engineers on the one hand and the public on the other hand, where there's an interesting comparison between the two.
Kind of a follow-up question on that. On these surveys that you're doing, is this a random sampling, or do you have a certain sector of the population that you've targeted, and mm-hmm. what is your particular sample size?
Yeah, the public opinion survey is a random digit dial survey. I believe the N was slightly over 1,000. It was conducted by our colleagues at Madison, University of Wisconsin-Madison. And the scientist survey, and this is very interesting, the scientist survey, as I suggested earlier, is not just a selection of any PhDs. We used the bibliometric work that we had done to generate a list of authors for all those articles that were collected. We selected the authors who were cited five or more times in the database that we had. We selected only those authors publishing from institutions in the United States and people who were first authors and not graduate students. And so these are highly cited nanoscientists. There ended up being somewhere in the neighborhood of 900 of them that we did a mail survey to, and we received responses from about 360 of them.
So is this, are you doing more nationally than internationally at this point?
Yes, that's correct. Although a number of the questions that we have on the public opinion survey correspond to questions that were recently asked in the Eurobarometer, which is the basic public opinion survey on these issues across all of Europe, and we're still working on the analysis of that data. But we will have not just the first longitudinal data that you've seen comparing very similar questions 2004 to 2007, but also the first data that you'll see really comparing across the same questions, European public opinion and U.S. public opinion.
Other questions from maybe Michigan? Or UIC or Puerto Rico?
No. No questions from Puerto Rico.
We've got a question here.
Okay.
Thank you. Would you talk a little bit more about the NTPF?
Okay. I've been invited to talk a little bit more about the National Citizens Technology Forum. And basically what this is, it has both an experimental aspect and a public policy aspect as well. You may be familiar with Citizens Technology Forums, or otherwise known as consensus conferences, and these have been conducted in Europe more frequently than they have in the United States, in smaller settings than a continental-wide democracy. So the place that has the most experience with these kind of citizen-based technology assessments is the country of Denmark. The Netherlands uses them frequently. Other places in Europe, like England, use them, but also for public education and engagement activities, and not just for, as in the case of Denmark and the Netherlands, informing public policymakers. And what these generally involve is the collection of 15 or so lay citizens who, over a series of 3 weekends in a month, get informed about an issue and deliberate about some aspects of it. And these have been done on in Europe and in the United States on a variety of issues, including genetically modified organisms, gasoline taxes, things like that. Our collaborator in North Carolina State University, Pat Hamlet, had been doing these locally under NSF sponsorship in North Carolina. And one of the protocols that he was testing locally was a predecessor for the ability to scale this up to a nation-sized activity here in the U.S. And so what he was doing was comparing face-to-face deliberations among 15 people sitting in the same room with internet-mediated deliberations, something like this, but not video, but simply keyboard-to-keyboard is what he called it. And public policy, deliberative democracy theory, and so forth would suggest that you get a lower quality deliberation through the keyboard-to-keyboard deliberations than you would in face-to-face. And what Hamlet found out in his trials was more or less contrary to that. He found that although the quality was different, it was not necessarily lower quality in keyboard-to-keyboard deliberations. And so that gave us an opportunity to think about constructing a national sample, a national citizens technology forum. And so what we're doing is having six sites across the country, Tempe, Madison, Atlanta, Boulder, Berkeley, and Durham, New Hampshire are our six sites. And then we'll have local citizens involved in one face-to-face meeting at the beginning of the month, a series of 10 internet-mediated meetings, synchronous and asynchronous, over the course of the month, and then a final face-to-face meeting at the end of the month. Each site is going to write a report on a question, as I suggested, in human identity enhancement and biology related to nanotechnology that they will refine more closely on their own. And then each site is going to reflect the demographics of the locale. And so where we get overlap among the reports that each site writes, we're going to plausibly have claim for a national perspective, an informed national public perspective on nanotechnology, something that, with respect to the earlier question about follow-up, is informed and is more a dialogic mode of inquiry about public information, public expectations, than an opinion poll is.
So that your center will plan to publish these reports?
Yeah, the reports from the individual sites will be published probably on our website, and then there'll be a report on the overlap that we will write and publish, and then there'll also be evaluation studies, pre-post testing, learning, and so forth among the participants that will be published as well. And in each of the areas, we'll be doing media work and connections with local policymakers and local non-government organizations, educational organizations, and so forth.
Any other questions among the conferencing sites? I guess I have another question about, in particular, education, which is our focus. Is there anything that you're doing in conjunction with education?
Yeah. A couple of things that we're working on, both in terms of formal education and informal education. On the formal side, we are partnering with the Center for Research on Education in Science, Mathematics, Engineering, and Technology, CRESMET, here on the ASU campus, to create a course for in-service high school teachers on nanotechnology in society. And we believe that this is this course is unique in the country for pre-college education, training teachers to teach about nano in society. In Arizona, as in many locales, science in context is part of the state expectations for science teaching, And we sort of leverage that into giving these in-service teachers an opportunity to extend their education in pursuit of their master's degrees, which they're doing here at ASU, and add a nano and society component to a master's degree that they might be taking. We ran the course for the first time last spring, and we'll be running it again in the coming spring. We're also on the informal science education side. We've been partnering with the Nanoscale Informal Science Education Network, the NICENET, on a variety of projects. One of which is to help us connect with more people in a better fashion about our scenario work. And so they're going to help us sort of technically reach a variety of different audiences with the scenarios that we're generating. Another thing that I believe started in part with the connection between NICENET and the NCLT is something that we're in the midst of called the 10 Big Ideas in Nano and Society. And I believe the folks at Northwestern had initially generated a list of 10 big ideas in nanotechnology, one of which was about nano and society. And the folks who were working with Northwestern at NICENET got in touch with us about that, and we started developing, it sort of exploded that one idea about nano and society into 10 ideas, and we're within a week or so away from delivering a product to NICENET about nano and society. And the hope is that these ideas, these social science ideas, might be able to be incorporated alongside the nanoscale science and engineering ideas that show up in museum exhibits and websites and so forth. One of the spin-offs of this is working with the NNIN, the National Nanotechnology Infrastructure Network, as a set of user facilities in the hopes of creating, through these 10 big ideas in nano and society, a nano and society training component for the users of the NNI facilities. And we're about to put into practice, I think, a memorandum of understanding with the NNIN about contributing to the training of their users in nano and society. And I should add that, you know, anybody at any of these other sites at NSECs or other nanoscale science and engineering sites who is interested in partnering in those kinds of activities, please feel free to be in touch with me, and we're happy to help out on that. So those are the sort of more outwardly oriented formal and informal science education aspects. We have undergraduate, graduate, and postdoctoral training programs as any regular academic research center as well.
Great. Thank you. Well, if there's no further questions, we do appreciate your time with us today, Mr. Gustin, and we're excited about what the work of your center is doing and helping to inform policy and the public in nanotechnology.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.